Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the first in the School of Business's occasional series of community lectures. My name's Andrew Smith. I'm the head of the School of Business at the University. And it's my considerable pleasure today to introduce to you our speaker for this morning, Ian Yeoman from Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. In talking to Ian before I started speaking, Ian likes to describe himself as a futurologist. He says he finds it a rather sexy title. Not just a scenario planner, but a futurologist. And futurology is actually quite a very... is an interesting area, actually. I was... a few years ago, I was at a conference in Germany, and during one of the breaks, I wandered out into one of the squares in Berlin and went into a little bookshop. Most of the, of course, books were in German, so I couldn't read them. But there was one here that was actually in English, and it was actually a history of futurology, which might sound a bit of a contradiction in terms, really, how you have a history of something that hasn't yet happened. But anyway, this book was a fascinating book. It was actually full of pictures from the 50s and 60s about how people then envisaged what life would be like now in the 21st century. And as you can imagine, probably in the 50s, you know, we were all dressed in silver suits, flying around on little flying saucers. And when we went home, robots did all the work for us. So they had this very kind of utopian vision back in the 50s and 60s of what the future will be like. These days, we've become a bit more jaded, I think, and a bit more pessimistic about the future. When we think of the future, we sometimes think of it, I sometimes think with dread rather than with hope, of the things that will go wrong, and we think that the future won't be as good as today. But as Ian reminded me, these things go in cycles, and so I'll be very interested to hear what he has to say with regard to tourism. Ian is a very well-known futurologist, and the practical work of futurologists these days is in the area that we, in the management discipline, sometimes call scenario planning, which has become a very important tool for corporations and organisations worldwide to essentially try and envision their future and then work out from what they think the future might be the kind of business strategy that their organisations will work with. And this is the area that Ian works very much in and has done a lot of work, for instance, for tourism in Scotland, working on scenario planning for the kind of futures that that country might expect in terms of its tourism, and what therefore tourism operators and government have to do to prepare to meet that likely future. Ian is highly qualified in this area. I'll read just a couple of extracts from his very impressive CV here. Ian's published extensively in the field of tourism futures, articles published in leading academic journals like Tourism Management Journal, Travel Research, Journal of Vacation Marketing, on a variety of topics from climate change to the future of energy and consumer trends, all within the context of travel and tourism. He's a popular speaker at conferences and was described by the UK Sunday Times as that country's leading contemporary futurologist. Ian's received a number of awards in recognition of his research, including his appointment as an honorary professor of tourism management at Stirling University, visiting research fellow at Sheffield Hallam University, Charles Forte Foundation Scholarship, and the Mike Simpson Award from the Operational Research Society. When he's not thinking about the future, Ian is a keen follower of Sunderland Football Club, which actually is very close to my heart because I was brought up in the very north of England as well, not actually in Sunderland, but not very far away. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce to you Ian Yeoman, who will be talking to us today about tourism in the future. Ian.
Good morning, and thank you for the invitation. This is my second visit to Ballarat. I was here in 1994, and all I remember of that was Sovereign Hill and gold. Just recalling it on a three-week trip touring New Zealand. Sorry, Australia. Wrong country. Right, thank you for... Thanks for inviting me. One of the things about me is I don't get out that much, because when I do go out, it's all doom and gloom. Because if you have a conversation to me, it's all about swine flu. It's all about the end of the world. You know, the end is nigh. So by the time you leave here, it'll all be doom and gloom, and you'll all be writing, you'll wish you weren't here. So people ask me not to talk rather than talk. So we're in this world today of volatility. We're in this world of swine flu, global financial crisis, and we're all thinking that it is the end of the world and it's going to end. So we'll explore some of those issues as we go along. So where shall we start with tourism? Well, tourism's rapidly changed because the world is a lot richer than it was 50 years ago. In 1950, 25 million international tourists took an international holiday. Today, 903 million international tourists take an international holiday. And that's forecasted by 2030 to rise to 1.9 billion tourists taking an international holiday. So you see astronomical and fast... You see a very fast pace of change in the terms of people taking holiday. And we're living in that experience economy with wealth, so people are taking holidays. So, every country in the world has a tourism proposition. Every country in the world has a Lonely Planet guide. 1979, the first Lonely Planet came out, and that was all about touring, getting to Australia. Whereas today, North Korea has a Lonely Planet guide. Afghanistan has a Ministry of Tourism and a Lonely Planet guide. Its tourism proposition are the last unconquered mountains of the world. Come and find Al-Qaeda. It's the guy that the Australian SAS reads when they're doing their trips through the mountains. There are countries that have Lonely Planet guides that didn't exist 20 years ago. And it's not just about countries that have Lonely Planet guides. It's about countries, it's about regions, it's about cities. North Pole, South Pole, Falkland Islands even has a Lonely Planet guide. So what I'm trying to say, it's a very competitive market. And that consumer has paradox of choice. Once upon a time, if you wanted to buy some cornflakes, go to the supermarket, you got cornflakes. Today, if you want to go to the supermarket and buy cornflakes, you get Nutty Crunch cornflakes, chocolate-flavoured cornflakes, gluten-free cornflakes, etc., etc. You've got paradox of choice, and that's for the tourist. It's the world's most competitive industry. So how do you compete? What do you do? So that's one starting point. Next starting point is we live in this world of volatility. Extreme volatility. Once upon a time, this is a real sign, if you went to the local barbers in the United States, you could get a mortgage at the same time. I don't know which one was cheapest, the haircut or the mortgage. But we've had fluidity and easy credit in the last 10 years. Easy credit, low interest rates, stable employment, high levels of disposable income have driven the growth in tourism, housing markets, and levels of prosperity. But today, we've seen lots of shocks. We've seen car manufacturing snowdive. We've seen many of the world banks being nationalised. We talk about GM going into 9/11. We see Chrysler being taken over by Fiat. The car industry has stopped. So we've seen lots of volatility within the market. Consumer confidence has stopped. Talked to consumers 2 years ago, what was the number one priority? What were you concerned about? Everybody said the environment. Today, it's economics in the terms of that. However, you've got to understand where are we in the terms of tourism. This is international arrivals to New Zealand. One of the things you've got to remember, we've had financial crises in the past. We've had flu pandemics in the past, 1918, 1954, 1968. But fundamentally, international arrivals have always risen. Levels of disposable income have always risen. If you take the typical Australian consumer, you, that's in the audience today, have twice as much disposable income in real terms as generations 22 years ago. Basically, your levels of disposable income rise or double every 22 to 25 years, and you're spending that on tourism. So where will the graph go? Will it continue to go upwards? And this is a representation of what's happening in New Zealand, Australia, and the rest of the world. But we live in this world of fear, myth of decline, culture of fear. We think the future is going to be worse than it was. But in fact, the future, what is the future? Look at this present generation. You're living longer, you've got more disposable income, you're better educated. So is the world going to end? I don't know. So I'm going to talk about two scenarios today. I finished a book last year called Tomorrow's Tourist, which fundamentally looked at world forecasts for tourism and looked at the tourist of tomorrow and what they were doing in niche markets. I'm doing a new book at the moment which looks at world tourism in 2050, very much fundamentally looking at the supply side. So this presentation is a combination of both books. And I'm going to talk about two scenarios. One is a society of plenty, and one is the scarcity of resources. Because one of the things I can't give you is an exact future. Because if I could give you an exact future, you know, I would do the lottery this weekend and I'd win millions. But I haven't got that. So society of plenty is fundamentally driven by affluence. We fundamentally say societies are getting richer, and as societies get richer, they spend more monies on tourism and out-of-home expenditure. And that's what's previously passed. But within this society, it's all about the myth of decline. Because within society, the more developed it gets, the more rules and regulations it creates, the more safety conscious it becomes. There's a generation of children within the UK who have never gotten on a bus to travel to school. I think it's unsafe. They wouldn't know what to do. You know, they go in the 4x4 SUVs. So safety and regulation and the fear of something is within the scenario. So let's talk about some of the characteristics of this scenario. The first one is about fluid identity. As consumers get more disposable income, it's very difficult to label them on what they are in the terms of their beliefs, because they develop, they evolve, they become a lot more mature, and they want diversity. They want to taste all of those cornflakes. They want to read all of those Lonely Planet guides and do them. That tourist in this scenario is extremely comfortable with a hedonist weekend in Las Vegas and at the same time doing an eco-tourism adventure in Africa. They will combine experiences. That's a representation of this. The average UK consumer changes their hairstyle every 18 months. The average Italian consumer changes their hairstyle every 13 months. So we're constantly changing, we're constantly evolving. We're constantly doing things. When you buy a car, you don't buy the same cars you bought previously. When you go on holiday, you want to try a new destination. It's a society which searches for something new constantly. It's the desire for new experiences. It's that experience economy we're involved in. So experiences, and something new. I haven't changed my hairstyle as often as David Beckham. I don't know about you. But these are the photographs of me. Don't I look handsome in my long johns, doing a tramp in New Zealand? It's a Kiwi thing, people tell me. But it's a representation of what we do on holiday. Today's holidays are not about the beach. We do a diversity of different experiences, and we taste different things. It's the rise of individualism and how we see the world and what we do. Very individualistic society. People will strike out and do their own thing. So there are lots and lots of trends that will shape the future. Today I can only talk about some of the more important ones that will give you a flavour of the future and what's going on. The top trend that will shape the world is demography. It's a trend that's constant. We all know the key OECD trends and what's going to happen to those markets. More older people, less younger people, getting married later in life, the rise of feminization of tourism products, having babies later in life, smaller families, etc., etc. So there's a lot that trend is constant. So what are the examples of this, and how does it represent itself in this society of plenty? Well, let's look at the world of Bridget Jones. In the 1950s, the female would marry young, would go straight from father to husband. You know, they wouldn't have a career in the middle, or it would be very short. They'd have 2 to 3 children. When they got married, they wouldn't continue to have a career, and they'd live till about 65. Well, societies change. 50 years later, they marry at 29. They have a career. they live outside the family. Once they leave home, they have a career, then they move to... Oops, let's come back. I didn't do anything. Okay. They bear one or two children. And they live till they're 80. I was reading a book the other day, because I'm single. What's the optimal age for a guy to find a woman? Can you guess what it is? In Australia? No. The optimal age for a guy to find a woman is 90. There are twice as many females in Australia at the age of 90. Did you know that? So if I hold out till I'm 90, I'm in with a chance. Society's changed. That's what I'm trying to say. And we do this. We live in a generation today. We live in China. You know, China's a world without brothers and sisters. One child policy. And the search for partners becomes a tourism product and a tourism experience. You know, online dating, shopping for brides. Chinese fellas searching other Chinese communities in the rest of the world for people of their ethnic mix. Products like solo holidays. You know, feminization of tourism. 78% of people that read a Lonely Planet guide are females under the age of 35. It's females that travel more than men around the world, isn't that generous? They're more of the interactive traveller. Companies in the terms of travel experiences, like in the UK, like Exodus or Explore, which promote small groups. Fundamentally, small group holidays that travel the world, go to Africa or India, and these experience or authentic type of holidays, are fundamentally it's single people that join that type of break. So singletons and travel is a core market in what they do. Other key area, but this is not the end of the family. It's not the end of the family. People talk about Bridget Jones and the end of family. Well, the opposite's true. Your connectivity with family is extremely strong. Your emotional connectedness with children, with parents and grandparents is 10 times as strong as your ex-partner once you get divorced. So family is extremely important in today's society and in future societies. Because if you live in a world of less children, you as parents or grandparents, because there'll be more of them, want to spend more time with them and more money of them. And if you look at childcare statistics, that's grandparents spending time with grandchildren. You've seen an astronomical growth in US markets from 1937 up to the 1980s. It's doubled in the terms of time. So grandparents become extremely important. So family is very strong going into the future in the terms of markets. So in the future, there'll be no such thing as youth hostels, because the world will be full of elder hostels. And an example of that in that market is what we call grand travelling. Grandparents taking grandchildren on cultural based activities and holidays across the world. So basically, as society gets older, you know, we're searching for more wrinkly cream. Health and health tourism becomes a lot more important. Whether it's you trying to make yourself body beautiful, or it's more of a spiritualism type of holiday. So health-related tourism in this society of plenty with aging demographics becomes a very important trend. And forecasts by the United Nations talk about health being the world's largest product or service, then by 2022, and tourism being the second. So tourism and health together become extremely important products going forward. The other thing that's changing is if you have a lot more singletons in society, it's the world of what we call urban tribes. This is singletons travelling in packs. Singletons become your new family and doing lots of different activities. So, you know, and a key representation of that is what we call a hen and stag party. We did a hen party 30 years ago. It was down the pub, a few beers, and that was it. Today, hen and stag parties, it's exotic locations. It's a five-day experience. It's trying different types of products and a whole range of different activities. So urban tribes, as seen by Ethel Watter's book, Ethan Watter's book, is a representation of that in the Society of Plenty. These are all representations of a changing society and what it means for tourism. The other thing in the Society of Plenty is, if you've got wealth, you're concerned about things. Because if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, things of safety, wealth are all satisfying. So it's all about self-actualization. And it's all about your concern for society. So we become concerned about ethical consumption. We become more concerned about authenticity. We move from this iconic experience economy to a more authentic experience, because it's all about high levels of disposable income, time, and a higher educated consumer. And a representation of that is the authentic tourist. That authentic tourist, it's all about an ethical product in the terms of ethical consumption. A product that's very natural, very honest, something that's rooted in the destination or the place. Something very beautiful and human. And that's what authenticity is all about. That's what that consumer's looking for in this society of plenty. Where they've got disposable income, they're very mature in the terms of their outlook, they're looking for that. So examples of that in the terms of tourism are authentic, real experiences where you get near human, where it's about lots of human activity, all about ecotourism. You know, and there's a self-actualization. There's a wow factor about that inner spirituality. And another consequence of that, what we've seen in the last 5 years, is a rise in volunteering holidays, whether it's you as a young 18, 19-year-old taking a gap year, or those aged 40 to 50 taking a mid-career break, or retiring early and doing something. Hello. Magic touch. Hello. So, in this society of plenty, authenticity is a very important driver in the terms of that consumer. In doing that, very getting back to basics, moving from experiences that are about Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck to this type of journey. And what you've got in this society of plenty is that debate. It's that debate between materialism and ecology. It's that debate, it's that conscious debate that's going on in your head. We want hedonistic activity and splashing out in new experiences, but at the same time, we're concerned about the environment. And it's all summed up in Oliver James's book, Affluenza. Are we too sick from that? So it's that debate. Because different consumers in different countries view it differently. If you're coming from an emerging economy, the BRIC economies of the world, the Brazils, the Russias, the Indias, the China, their concern for tourism experiences is all about materialism. A Russian consumer spends 20 times more on shopping in Dubai than a UK consumer. UK consumer spends £500 per visit to Dubai on shopping, whereas a Russian spends £5,000 shopping in Dubai. So very materialistic outlook in the terms of concern.
Have you said there's a lot less Russians in Dubai?
At the moment there is.
More affluent.
Yeah. Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is society that's coming from the bottom and merging through, they're more concerned with material possessions. If you ask them what they want, it's all about big expensive plasma TVs, luxury perfumes, etc., etc. If you ask them a range of questions, whereas if you ask a UK consumer or a consumer from an advanced OECD economy, it's more about me, time, spirituality, and time on my own. So one's a lot more authentic and one's a lot more materialistic in the terms of experiences. That's what I'm trying to get. So there's a debate there. There's a debate there. What markets are you looking at and what do they want? And you also, the other debate is about world tourism. Advanced economies like Germany, the UK, the United States, they do a lot more travelling. There's a lot more tourists of them. And countries from OECD countries, they're the emerging middle classes. There's fewer of them, and they're just starting to travel in terms of interregional. Okay. Right. So if we've got this debate about society, what's the next scenario? Well, the next scenario is about scarcity of resources. This is more of the impact of climate change. This is more of the impact of sustainability and demography, and also the use of innovation in the terms of technology. What happens in the future, there's just less of it, fundamentally. There's less labour, because there's less young people. There's less water in society, and climate change has taken impact. So that's what this scenario is all about. So, there's Mr. Polar Bear. It's a representation. Fundamentally, the world is getting warmer. And as a consequence, you've got rising tides, less rainfall, less water available. And as a consequence, tourism products and tourism experiences will change. There's no doubt about that. So, we live in a society, it's all about how do you live. We live in a society today, have we consumed too much? Because the impact of climate change is all about man. It's all about man and it's all about woman. So we've indulged ourselves too much. And therefore, as a consequence of that, it has an impact upon tourism. So the debate is about our behaviour. Hello. The debate is about our behaviour and what we do.
It doesn't like
that. It doesn't. It's trying to hide. So, basically, this room, have you seen the film Wall-E? The ball does, you know, the cartoon film, that reminds me of what, you know, Wall-E is. We become very obese. We just eat and eat and eat, and we take off into outer space and we abandon the planet. So, that's what it's about in terms of futuristic. So, what do you want it to be? What do you want tourism to be? And where will you be? That's me. Just there on holiday in China. Because what you're facing with in today's society, in terms of tourism, massive growth. And what will that tourism experience be? And as those societies from India and China emerge, it's about big tours, big mass tourism experiences, and as cheaply as possible in the terms of trying to make an access. So there's a representation here. What do you want your tourism experience to be? Is it something very mass market like it is here, and the carbon footprint, or the footprint, is extremely big, or is something else in the terms of that? Because the impact of humans and what they do in the terms of tourism consumption is big. So, just taking figures from the UNWTO and other studies about the impact of climate change, we're talking about 58% of the world's coral reefs are at risk moving into the future. We're talking about seawater expected to rise up to 70 centimetres in the next 10 years, ensuring that there will be no Venice and there will be no Seychelles. We're talking about species of animal and plant life disappearing at the rate of 1 every 3 minutes. We're talking about a land area about the half the size of Paris is cleared for golf courses. And we're talking, therefore, about the development in the terms of golf. A typical golf course in Thailand uses as much water as 60,000 rural villages. We're talking about a medium-sized hotel uses the same amount of water in one day as a small village of 100 families, etc., etc., etc. So it's what that impact will be. And if the forecast for world tourism moves from 900 million international arrivals to 1.9 billion international arrivals by 2030, what is the impact of that in the terms of tourism? Because if we look, in order to cater for this type of number and this big increase in number, this is what the future cruise ship looks like. The future cruise ship of the future is fundamentally an aircraft carrier in the terms of access, in the terms of what it is. So what's the impact of something like this on the environment and what we do and how do we cater for it? Because we're moving, it's that desire for new experiences, it's that desire to see the world. And cruise ship development at the moment, it's just trying to make everything bigger. So again, it's what the consequences of the human footprint on tourism. And this is an example of the Freedom Ship project. And what's important for tourism, if you don't control the debate, if you don't lead on the debate on green issues, and on sustainability, and you control the debate, and you ensure your future, somebody else will tell you what your future is all about in the terms of green issues. So if you don't champion the cause of the environment, somebody will tell you what to do, to the detriment of tourism and what you're doing. There's a trend here called assault on pleasure. And assault on pleasure is all about telling you, it's the Puritan in society, telling you what you should be doing. You know, clean your home with lemon juice, blend your own baby food, get DVDs from the library, wear second-hand clothes, cut your car at journey time, give time rather than gifts. These are all very good things, but it's the cumulative effect if you add them all up together. It's society telling you how to behave. Because tourism, in the terms of debate, air transport is a polluter. But you have to manage that debate in the terms of your presentation. Because if you don't, somebody else will. Example of what's happening in New York. The debate about mineral water and bottled water. People drink bottled water because they perceive it's safer than tap water. But the impact of drinking lots of bottled water is all about landfill sites. So pressure from pressure groups and councils introduces legislation into the city of New York on a range of items. The type of fats that you cook with, the use of water, etc., etc. So you have to control the debate about your future. You have to enhance it. Other key drivers that are going into the future is about wealth and disposable income. Where markets will come from. This is a graph taken from a study by McKinsey, which talks about the top five cities in China. And in 1985, their classification of wealth in these top five cities, they said 98% of the population could be classified as poor. And only 2% of those populations living in that city, in terms of purchasing power parity, as lower middle class or better. But the forecast is, by 2025, only 10% of that population will be seen as poor, and 90% of that population in those cities will be seen as lower middle class or better. So it's a representation of their purchasing power in real terms. However, that purchasing power is not the same as the United States. By 2030, even with that graph, we're still talking about US consumers on average still having 20 to 25 times as more purchasing power than the average Chinese consumer. And the same goes for India. But these markets will rise rapidly. They will only go up. So if you combine that with some other key trends, and those other key trends within this graph are demography. Some of the key trends, it all depends where you go. So is the future about shortage of labour and help wanted? Scarcity of resources? Because hospitality and tourism is fundamentally a labour-intensive product. And it's fundamentally about those under the age of 25 that provide the majority of the workers. And as the society gets older, there's a lot more competition from other industries for that reducing and contracting labour supply. You know, the biggest provider of labour going to 2030, 2040, will be the healthcare system, because there's just more older people that will demand it. So what's happening in Japan with a rapidly aging society is a symbol of what's coming next. I don't know. So what I want to look at is Japan and Japan society, and talk about Japan's economy, and is Japan's economy a reflection of what's coming next? Because it's also a good case study of what's happening with the world global crisis. This is an example of basically the price of houses in Japan. Japan has had this thing called deflation since 1992, the lost decade. Once upon a time, talking about the early 80s and 90s, the Japanese tourists were the travellers of the world. But they sort of disappeared. We don't talk as much about the typical Japanese tourist in Ballarat Australia or New Zealand as we did in the early 90s. So fundamentally, with deflation, and deflation's what the world economy has got at the moment, and many advanced OECD economies, is where prices don't go up. Prices consistently fall. This is if you've got money in the bank, it's negative interest rate. The bank charges you for putting your money in the bank. It's happened once in Switzerland. This is what it's all about. The price of your house constantly falls. With deflation, within 3 years, the price of property in Japan fell by 60%, and it's fundamentally never recovered. So deflation is bad for tourism in the terms of travel. And if we map that, house prices against other leading OECD countries, places like the UK, the United States and Spain, the house prices have peaked around 2007 and then are in this fall mode. So what do we expect? Is deflation going to be part of our everyday life as we move forward in the terms of the decade? And is your price of your property going to fall by 40 to 60% in the next 3 years and fundamentally never recover? I don't know. It's that debate. And what's good to look at is what's happened to the Japanese economy in the terms of tourism. If we look at outbound that tourist travels, what's happened in Japan? Talk about 1992 here. What happened with you had around 1992, you still had growth in the terms of tourism coming here. And fundamentally, it was all about senior travel. It was the seniors or those that had retired in the terms of tourism. They were still travelling. But as they started to have less and less disposable income, it became very stagnant. Their tourism flow, their tourists stopped the flow. And what you've seen in the last couple of years is outbound tourists in Japan start to fall off. The other thing that's fundamentally happened in Japan is all about out expenditure. The youth market in Japan are today not keen travellers. They'd rather spend their money on in-home entertainment than outbound travel. In terms of experiences, they're more comfortable with their Xbox rather than an outdoor experience. So what's also happened in the terms of reflection, in the terms of the Japanese economy, because it's in deflation, you've had continuous decline in the terms of demand. You've had continuous erosion. Not even a domestic market can substitute for international market. So you had lowering demand. Because you've got less disposable income per capita, you're switching expenditure and you're saving. And it's fundamentally had a big impact in the last couple of years on key indicators, and that's transport. Basically, if you look at public transport and demand for airline travel from a domestic market, you're seeing decline in that Japanese tourist flying from A to B in the terms of interconnectivity between cities. So you're seeing that fall off in demand. They'd rather spend that money on in-home technologies and experiences. And a key indicator of that is what happened to golf. In 1990, people talk about golf being the bastion of the key indicator of tourism and wealth and activity. But you've got fundamentally 50% less in the number of registered golfers in Japan compared to 1992 compared to 2007. So people have cut expenditure. And what has it meant for what's happened in Japan, what's happening now, is the overdevelopment of golf courses and revenue per round of golf dramatically falling. So again, the consequence of what may happen with the economic environment of deflation. So what does that all mean? What we had with technology and that experience economy, our expectations have changed. In the terms of giving me something that's big and bold, I will find it better to watch a baseball match or a cricket match on the TV rather than going to the live event. It's all about the development of in-home technology. I'd rather have the lads round for a couple of beers, watching this type of experience. And if anybody's got any spare cash, Carl's Sport Outdoor Theatre costs you $30,000, comes with a 60,
It's an outdoor theatre, 63-inch LCD. Touch comes with DVD, CD player, 5-burner barbecue ring, a wet bar, waterproof recliners with cup holders. Okay? But it's a representation of taking outdoor experiences and virtual and bringing them into the home. The development of HDTV, helps us go there. So again, it becomes a threat to what you do. So a lot of, you've got competition. Your competition in this scenario is not just other tourism attractions, but it's other forms of leisure activity. And that's what you're competing with in the terms of for that consumer's dollar. Other key drivers of change, it's all about the world of technology, science, and discovery. If we take the meetings business and conferences business for the future, in today's society, we've seen if I'm a doctor and going through medical school, what medicine will look like in 2030 will be completely different from what medicine will look like today. So what it means for the meetings industries, doctors with conventions or healthcare, and not having their congresses every 5 years in big locations, they're meeting every 2 years in smaller locations because they have to keep pace with technological innovation and discovery and medicines coming through. So you've got rapid change in technology discovery. And you're going to see a couple of British telecom futurologists talk about in the next 5 years you'll see more technological change than you will in the next 150 years. And some of the examples of that technology change is examples of this. I've just read David Levy's book. He talks about love, sex with robots. Talk about sex tourism of the future. You know, it's that robot, and it's the world of the Stepford Wife. That type of invention in the terms of doing that, in terms of our relationship with things. So technology in the world of robots is moving on. It's that world of utopia and how we're getting there. So I don't know, he's a quick movie on how technology and the world of robotics can change society, which is this.
Synthesis of man and machine.
I think we are probably putting more and more robotic technology inside us. Robotic joints, replacement limbs. A lot of people now, over 100,000, have cochlear implants with direct neural connections into their cochlea from a computer so they can hear.
Doctors using cutting-edge technology to heal.
There will be a day when amputees are wired up electrically. They're wired up mechanically, and it's really a part of their body, even though aspects of the prosthesis may still be synthetic. So in that world, amputees will not only be able to walk across the sand beach, but will actually feel the sand against their synthetic foot.
And researchers using that same technology to open direct communication between the brain and computers.
One of the big breakthroughs in neuroscience is that we can tap into those signals and we get many complex electrical impulses from those neurons, yet we can read out those signals and by some not too complex mathematical techniques, we can put them back together in a way that we can interpret what the brain is trying to do.
A lot of our industrial infrastructure is going to rely more on biological materials. So we're going to start building robots out of biological materials. Well, we're putting silicon and steel inside ourselves. And then what's a robot, what's us, is going to start to get a bit messy.
You're not going to be able to walk into a room in 2035 and say, okay, humans on the left side of the room, machines on the right. You'll have a hard time finding a human that doesn't have extensive amounts of technology inside them, in the form of nanobots and other systems that are keeping them healthy and also extending their range of experiences and their intelligence.
fascinating stuff there. Ray Kurzweil is right. What will it be like to be alive and full of technology? What will it mean to be human? Stay with us. We're going to discuss that when we come back.
So technology is becoming that. And if we look at generations, you know, it's generations. Today's youth of the market have grown up with the use of technology. They would feel lost without their BlackBerry or without their mobile phone. You know, you can even join if you've got withdrawal symptoms, you've lost your email. You can go into BlackBerry Anonymous now. You have counselling groups that deal with this type of thing that we have today in the terms of that. But you in society has changed. Society is the world of individualism. And consumers have a lot more higher expectations in the terms of technology. When they go into a hotel bedroom, they expect all of the gadgets. You know, they expect that flat screen TV, wireless access. You know, technology, in the terms of usage, becomes a common occurrence, becomes a hygiene factor, not a distinguishing factor. In the terms of, and our behaviours changing. These students here on the front row, you know, if they get asked out on a date now, it's not by one-to-one conversation. They will be sent a text message. You know, fancy going out for a pint tonight, or you know, want to be my escort to the ball, or that type of thing. There was a recent survey by Vodafone, which said in the terms of breakup of relationships and divorces, 3% of all announcements for divorces today came via text message. So by the time you switch on your mobile phone at the end of this lecture, I don't know what will happen. So technology's changed. And if we look at the future of football and stadiums, that interaction, you get a better experience at home. You get that better experience at home than you do if you go to the real event in the terms of viewing. Why would you spend $300 to see Status Quo in Sydney when you're 2 miles away? You know, you're that little speck in the right at the front. Again, it's how do we interrelay individuality and experiences in terms of interpretation with real events? Is the future of football or rugby or any stadium type events this type of console? This type of interaction, where you as the fan can replay everything, where you as a fan can do things, because technology is changing what we do and how we see things and what we interpret. You know, today, you know, what I'm trying to say with technology, if this is the world of McDonald's and this is the world of Starbucks, and these are the values that they had. If you do something wrong with that experience, the experience on YouTube is this. When I went to university, somebody used to tell me, if you had a bad experience, you would tell 6 people. Today, if you go and have a bad experience, they tell the rest of the world. So don't pretend to be something that you are not. Don't overpromise. Because consumers may not complain, but they'll tell everybody else in the terms of connectivity. You know, today, if you look at the news reportage, you know, a lot of news reportage today, you know, it's via Twitter. It's via your mobile phone. You know, it's you as the consumer that send the message to Sky or to the newspaper website or to a TV program hello? That's all right.
The divorce.
what I'm trying to say, technology and society and social media has completely changed and how we view things and how we interact and how we interact with things. Today we live in a society of an immediate culture, instant society, where connectivity is there. You know, at times the UK Times newspaper sent a journalist to the Crimea War back in Victorian times, and it took them 3 months to get that story into the Times in London. Whereas today, the newspaper reporter goes to war with the soldier as the embedded reporter. So technology has changed on what we do. Other key drivers that will have an impact on tourism is transport. Tourism is all about connectivity. Key changes that we see in society is an urbanisation of the world. People living in rural communities moving to big cities. You see astronomical growth over the next 20 to 30 years of cities like Sydney, Tokyo, Berlin, London. They astronomically grow. And it's about the correct infrastructure for those types of cities. But there are key questions in the terms of international aviation. When do we have peak oil? Because 96% of road transport, or 96% of transport, is about oil. So when does the oil run out? And people ask, do people just stop flying? I don't know. So what you see is innovation come about. Cities are all about right types of cities in the terms of light railways, or interconnectivity with trains and public transport becomes more of a gender. Different types of cars, etc., etc. People talk to me about the world of oil and it's going to come to an end. Well, it's not going to come to an end. The higher the price of oil or petroleum, the more levels of innovation that you have. You've got to remember, this guy called Hitler was an innovator. Between 20 to 35% of oil used by tanks in the Second World War in Germany were distilled from or refined from coal in the terms of change. We find alternatives. So the higher the price of oil, we talk about coal to liquid, biodiesel, ethanol, methanol hydrates, hydrogen economy, battery-powered car, tar sands. The higher the price of oil, there is an alternative. Man is very adaptable in what they do in facing crisis. It does not become the end of the world. So, I've talked about many issues relating into the future. Demography, technology, I don't know what the right answer is going to be. But the purpose is taking these trends and understanding them and trying to talk about some of the implications. So, what is the future? How do we perceive the future? Is it doom or is it gloom?
I am part of a lost generation and I refuse to believe that I can change the world. I realize this may be a shock, but happiness comes from within is a lie, and money will make me happy. So in 30 years, I will tell my children they are not the most important thing in my life. My employer will know that I have my priorities straight because work is more important than family. I tell you this, once upon a time, families stayed together. But this will not be true in my era. This is a quick fix society. Experts tell me 30 years from now, I will be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce. I do not concede that I will live in a country of my own making. In the future, environmental destruction will be the norm. No longer can it be said that my peers and I care about this earth. It will be evident that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It is foolish to presume that there is hope. And all of this will come true unless we choose to reverse it. There is hope. It is foolish to presume that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It will be evident that my peers and I care about this earth. No longer can it be said that environmental destruction will be the norm. In the future, I will live in a country of my own making. I do not concede that 30 years from now, I will be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce. Experts tell me this is a quick fix society, but this will not be true in my era. Families stayed together once upon a time. I tell you this, family is more important than work. I have my priorities straight because my employer will know that they are not the most important thing in my life. So in 30 years, I will tell my children, money will make me happy is a lie, and true happiness comes from within. I realize this may be a shock, but I can change the world. and I refuse to believe that I am part of a lost generation.
I think what I'm trying to say by the video is the tourism industry, you're actually in the happiness industry. It's about making happiness. It's not about economic development. You know, if you go to Bhutan, they don't measure their economy by GDP. They measure it by gross domestic happiness. And speaking about the topic of happiness, the happiest people in the world are Danes, and the happiest profession in the world is a hairdresser. So if you ever meet a hairdresser from Denmark, they're absolutely spaced out. Anyway, I've taken you on a journey to talk about the future. It's up to you to... You're the only people that control your destiny. Very much the future studies or futurology scenario planning is about thoughts, and it's also about turning thoughts into action. Anyway, if you want to know more, you can look at my website. You can all buy multiple copies of my book. I don't mind. Or you can contact me there. Thank you very much.
I have the happy task now of taking questions, and thank you for that huge journey. I'm not too sure I believe your statement that you don't get out much. You seem to make very good use of the time you do get out. And for synthesising so much of what you've experienced and read and learned. So, very happy to take some questions. Tim.
Thanks, Anne. Could you explore a little bit more for us what you meant when you're talking about authenticity? I've understood that you're talking about the authenticity is the visitor's experience.
Yeah.
Can you use the term hygiene factors and attributes?
Our society is more educated today, and has wealth, and is a lot more mature in society. They've moved from, I think there's a book by Pine and Gilmore called The Experience Economy. It's all about experiences and performance and that type of thing. But we've now moved on from there, and as that consumer is more mature, they're looking for real experiences in the terms of authenticity. They're looking for the attributes that David Boyle mentions in his book. He's looking for experiences where there's a connection with reality, something very real and tangible. He's talking about human contact in terms of interpretation. He's talking about ethical consumption, because that consumer of today is very aware of what's going on in the environment. So it's about how do you behave and what you do. Because today's generation, you know, within your lifetime, you'll probably boycott 3 to 4 products or experiences. You're very aware what's going on with you. And also tourism experiences have to be a representation of that destination. So if Las Vegas is all about gambling, it's a good gambling experience in the terms of that type of authenticity. Do what you do and do it well, and it has to have that history and that route of where it is. So that consumer's very much ingrained in that type of experience. And the growth of tourism has been more about niche markets and niche products, and that more connectivity and customization with that tourist. So in the terms of authenticity, it's more about what the place stands for in terms of its beliefs, its attributes and its ethics, and then manifesting that across into tourism. You're seeing that. You know, the charter flights are less, there's less of them. The package holiday, there's less of them. And there's more individuality in the terms of tourists doing that deeper and more meaningful type of experiences. Don't know if that, there's anything you want, is that what you're talking?
Yes.
Yeah.
Just to say that from Sophocles,
yeah.
We are seeing that there may be something which is generational, part of
yeah.
the cycle that we're talking about, mapping it over the line of
yeah.
is that we still do have a very large segment of our visiting public coming in package tours,
yeah.
and their expectations are quite different from those people who are more mature travellers from other parts
yeah.
of the world, and free independent travellers, and what our domestic market is looking at. That authenticity is defined more by a relationship with their values and their
it isn't. There's a debate around that. It's what I talked about, this thing about it, it's more difficult to segment consumers, and consumers are a lot more fluid in the terms of their identity and what they will experience. They're quite comfortable staying in a 5-star hotel on a city break, whereas at the same time they're very comfortable staying, you know, roughing it, tramping in a youth hostel in the terms of that identity. And there's key markets going into the future about demography and cost and what that means for that package type of experience, which is another question in another study.
I'm just interested in one of the facts you have on the slide saying that for the next 10 years, sea levels will rise by 70 centimetres. Just wondering where the facts came from, where that information
Two sources came from Rachel Dodds, who is an assistant professor of sustainable tourism at Ryerson University in Canada. And if you go onto her website, sustainabletourism.net, you'll find that fact. And they also, I think she took the fact from a study on climate change by the UNWTO, which did a big study on climate change in tourism, which is a free report available from UNWTO.org, I think. Something like that. So that's where that statistic came from.
I heard lots of estimates nothing has been that.
Again, one of the things about futures is there's no exact future. There's a range of different figures of what goes on. It all depends on the scenario you take from the IPCC and the level of climate warming up. So interesting.
Now we've got Caroline, perhaps, and then Ian.
In your presentation, the issues that climate change become one of a number of factors. Does that sort of reflect the effect that you think climate change will have? I mean, I'm a person who thinks that climate change will be a major factor in relation to aviation, particularly in Australia and New Zealand. 99% of our tourists come by air, and we drive around a lot.
Okay, two questions. Well, climates have always changed since the year dot, and there's no getting away from that. So it's all about mitigation and adaptation and understanding where the change will occur. So that's one factor. Climate change in the terms of debates has been central to many of the debates within politics across the world. And there's one theory that said we've had the collapse of socialism, so in order to counter socialism, we've gone into a debate about the environment, because we've moved to the issue of party politics as about single issues rather than people don't join political parties today, they go on to single issues. So that debate has been heightened in the terms of where it is in people's conversations. Tourism has all, air transport will always be a polluter. But it's the debate between, it's all about economic development. And economic development, in terms of sustainable development, is more than the environment. It's all about jobs, communities, social aspects, and technology aspects within that debate. And I don't see any countries in the world, if they went and banned air transport, they'd be committing political suicide. Because the consequence knock-on effect for travel and tourism would be very, very big. And there's also a big difference between what consumers say and what consumers do. A survey by Sainsbury's 2008, which talked about ethical consumption, talked about, if you listed the fact, asked the consumers, are you concerned about the environment, are you concerned about ethical consumption, and it was somewhere right at the top of the box. But when they examined consumers' basket of goods when they came out, less than 0.005% have actually done something about it. Again, it talks about surveys. There's been a number of surveys that talked, would you change your travel behaviour if it had some sort of impact on the environment? Majority of consumers would say no. The key driver is supply-side structures and supply-side changes. What governments do to introduce legislation or try and change behaviour. So, and that's the debate, how they've changed on seatbelts or drink driving. It will be governments that drive change. Because sustainability will also come from businesses. For example, within the meetings incentive business, when a tender goes out from an organisation, say, for the Pharmaceutical Society of Germany for a World Congress for 2010 for 5,000 bed nights, it's not about what you'll do and what you'll present, but they're also looking for the ethical issues. They're also looking for the impact on the environment and what you do. So cities and conference venues have to be involved in climate change and sustainability, whether it's transport or how you deal with the rubbish in the terms of behaviour. What we'll see with air transport is more proficiency with aircraft design, more proficiency with engines, the debate around routes in the terms of carbon emissions that you have from CO2 emissions and stacking. And there's also a debate about engine design, CO2 emissions against sulfur and noise and against Balancing Act as well. So we will still have air transportation in the future unless you believe in teleportation as you see on Star Trek. Unless that comes true. But you've got to remember that I don't see that as feasible. So air transport is right at the front of the agenda, and there'll be technology innovation, but I don't see countries committing suicide in the terms of saying get rid of aircraft and stopping flying, because it's all about cost, time, and convenience. Well, there are several things about, for example, routes. It's how you fly from A to B. What's the most efficient way? Because the most efficient way is not the way that aircrafts fly. There's about capacity planning and scheduling of airports and the number of CO2 emissions that you have that's involved when airplanes stack or are flying the airport and waiting to land. You'll see regulation from many governments on emissions, and there will be emissions targets for aircraft design, etc., etc. There'll be legislation on financial issues. They will be saying, by 2014, your engine must be like this. So these are the changes that you will see coming through.
Thanks.
My name is Ian Knox. I'm from the University of Israel. I'm a lecturer in business and marketing, so that's my interest area. I quite often use tourism travel sites in my classes as an example of an industry that hasn't evolved particularly well. In fact, most of the tourism travel sites are used as sort of examples of worst practice. If, for example, I saw an advertisement for Solomon Hill and I was looking to go to Ballarat, and my inclination would be to be immediately go on a social networking site and see what consumers are saying about that. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the trends in terms of online facilitation of tourism and public relations, I suppose, and where consumers are going to get their information from?
Okay, if you look at the trends in the terms of booking patterns and what you do today, the tourist of today is very much no longer monolithic. They don't look at one source and say, I'm going to do A, B, and C. What they're doing now is reading books, magazines, responding to an advert, searching other consumers. So they're a lot more interactive and looking for a multitude of different things in terms of searching for information before making a decision on what to do. We're not going to see the end of the guidebook, because some people like it. It's a very physical thing. It's seen as having some sort of independent source. The key influence on how do I make a choice for a holiday is actually friends and family, because it has high degrees of trust in the terms of things. Some of the social networking sites in the terms of, let's take Facebook or Bebo, some of the discussion groups, there's degrees of trust in what people say and what people do in the terms of that. So The other thing that we'll see change is many DMOs, destination marketing organizations, will spend less on advertising, and they'll spend more money on the website, but also consumer stories. I'm going to sponsor a journalist from the UK Sunday Times to come to Ballarat to spend a weekend, and I want you to write a nice story about me in the terms of influence, seen as independent. So they are some of the changes that we'll see coming through. It's more about marketing, more about technology, and less about advertising and direct marketing in terms of degree of influence. And the market will decide it in terms of.
We have a question for Beth Rowe, thanks.
Do you see, probably not good for the environment, but do you see any good market for the single person travelling without having to pay huge amounts of single supplement? Is there a market there to focus on many single people that are travelling but have to spend huge amounts on single supplement?
That's a very good issue in the terms of the singleton. Two things about the singletons, what I've already spoken about, what we call the urban tribes. That's singletons travelling together in groups and packs and doing that type of holiday. But on the other hand, there will still continue to be single supplements, and that area will still continue to be around. You know, you'll be paying per room rather than per person, etc., etc. So, you know, that market will be there. But there's other key activities in the terms of the single market. One of the big increases and big trends that we're seeing at the moment is day tripping markets for the over 50s market. You know, the over 55s, you get the free bus pass or free travel pass, and you're seeing big increases in that market. That's happening now in the terms of tourism. Sorry, your observations and your comments. What's your observation about where that will go?
Oh, well, it annoys me intensely. I have lots of single friends who wish to travel and have private accommodation, of course. And as you're saying, there are lots more single people, particularly probably in the over 55.
Yeah.
Well,
and other things that's happening with that market, there's also a growing market where people are subletting their own rooms, you know, on websites ad hocly and available for this type of traveller as well.
there's possibly a new niche for Formula One with a core there, Janet. We have another question here, and then we'll go to back to you.
My question relates back to the previous question about trade-offs with air travel and tourism and where it all ends. I think I saw a program not long ago that said the only trade-off, the immediate trade-off that can be made is time. All the aircraft are basically governed to come as fast to get from A to B. If they took their foot off the accelerator 20%, they would save humongous amounts of fuel and greenhouse emissions. So it seems to me that the only trade-off is going to be time, instead of this very quick society and travel. The whole pace of society and travel is going to go under the microscope. Especially with regard to overseas travel, but if you took the foot off the accelerator and a little bit more time to get there, and then reduce the overall environmental impact.
I don't know. I'm going to make several observations. If you're in the short break market, you know, people staying coming to a destination for 2 to 3 days, connectivity is extremely important in the terms of time. And the time allowance is usually, I leave the office on a Friday night at 5 o'clock and I want to be in the destination by 8, 9 p.m. So connectivity in the terms of scope is extremely important. Time inefficiency is usually associated with newer transport.
in the terms of energy efficiency, it's newer aircraft, faster trains that are more energy efficient, and the impact on the environment is less compared to slower, some of the older or slower forms of transport. So that's the only observation and comments I can make about that in the terms of that. I haven't seen the individual report.
Gary Morse, take it from you.
Gary Sutherville. In infrastructure, with the huge movements of emerging markets such as China and India, do you see in the future there's going to be more government support in this area, like training and so on, to start forms of transport around the nation and so on?
Well, transport. I don't know. I haven't got the answer. You know, the cost of governments going into the future, short term, over the next 5 years, most OECD countries are talking about big public sector deficits. So many countries of the world at the moment are talking about actually cutting back projects because they haven't got the funding available. Because many countries have pump-primed public sector projects this year, next year, in order to generate employment or secure employment. But it's led to massive borrowing on banks, and therefore many councils or public sector agencies are working with major deficits. So you're going to see prioritisation across the world on what we can do and what we can't, and what we can't do. So there's one thing. Public transport and infrastructure investment, it's not fundamentally about tourism. It's fundamentally about cities and work and the correct type of infrastructure that you need for that. Then the tourism equation goes on top of that. New Zealand's a very green and clean country, but its transport infrastructure internally is quite poor. You know, there's one train that leaves Wellington to get to Auckland. It takes 8 hours to get there. It's fundamentally for the tourists, and all of the carriages are 1960s and 1970s second-hand stuff from the UK. But the economic case, in the terms of developing structure, it's fundamentally around demography and demography density. So, and then trying to put tourism tourism onto that, and the changes that will come through from that. So it's a hard one to call.
Thanks. I think Donna had a question, and then thanks, Donna.
Mine's actually more a comment. I don't know if you guys could relate the lady that was talking about a single travel, and in fact, I mean, accommodation is one of the biggest expenses when you travel.
Yeah.
And there are some niche markets and stuff. It's just a matter, I think, of finding the right places. Because, you know, as you said, it's like, you know, the niche marketing is important, and niche businesses. And it depends on where you're going and what you're wanting to do and that sort of thing. Because there's quite a lot of accommodation that are sort of small, independent accommodation that can accommodate single people quite easily. In terms of the way, you know, because they may be like holiday houses, for example, like I have actually a business like that. I have a holiday accommodation in Tasmania, and we do cater for single people, and because we can, because our setup is such that we can do that. But like a big hotel, it's not quite as easy for them to do that. They have a room that is a double room, and whether they have a double person, you know, two people or a single person, it still costs them the same to provide that room and maintain that room. So it's more, you know, getting into some of those niche, you know, some of those smaller accommodation areas or some of those different types of accommodation rather than big hotels.
And just a comment to go back on that. It'll be fundamentally, if the future is singletons, that type of market, it will be the market that decides. The market will go where the profits are in the terms of reaction and change towards that.
One of those futurist ideas is if all of us old people are going to be in aged care, and they're actually the same home, we've got these young people looking after us, who's going to be running a tourism business and who's going to be in it?
Well, that's a very good point in the terms of adaptability, what is the future workforce? Is it all of those robots and stuff like that, or is it it's the nature of work and how work will change, and it's how retirement will change, and doing, you know, basically there's all of these intelligent, mature, well-educated retirees who are actually quite easily bored, and what they want to do in terms of supplementing their income and just trying to keep active. So that workforce comes back. And I was talking about an earlier example of IBM. IBM in the United States has reallocated work from New York to St. Petersburg in Florida for one fundamental reason. Young people... older workers are a lot more diligent, turn up on time, a lot more accurate when it comes to basic clerical work. So they've reallocated some work from New York to St. Petersburg based upon this, the changing mode of work and what retirees do. So what we mean by work and what we do that is some key questions. So if you want to keep your business going, it's about adaptability. Who is the hospitality worker of the future? Is a new work, and I'm also writing a new book on the future of demography. You're quite willing to... I'll put it on the website later. Thank you.
Just on that, I'm aware that Don Richter, who's the head of strategic marketing at Tourism Victoria, has been very keen to pursue conversations with government about offsetting the tax liability of a business in return for employing semi-retirees who have travelled and, as Ian has said, have got these fabulous attributes. So perhaps those of us who've lost our super, you know, we've got a future after all. Now, that looks like the end of questions. I am keen to see that one of the contemporary tourism issues class might have a question to facilitate your assessment. Absolutely. Now, Simon, you're looking pretty keen.
This is the planted question, is it?
No.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, okay. Oh, that's true, yes. Yeah.
So we have no more questions. Thank you indeed for that. Just before we conclude and thank Ian formally, events of this kind don't occur without quite a bit of work on the part of a number of people. Principally, we must... send our thanks to our generous head of school that you saw a little earlier. Without the kind of sponsorship that we have to bring Ian here and to share his discussions with our tourism students, that's not possible. So thank you, Andy. Elisa Backer. Elisa is a relatively new appointment to our staff, and putting to work all the good behaviours that an academic does. Elisa was at a conference in New Zealand last year, had a conversation with Ian, and the outcome of all good networking, I think, has seen here. So thank you, E. That's a lot of work and commitment to see people actually arrive. Also, we've had tremendous support from our admin staff, Catherine and Kathy at reception, and Debbie and Leona, who aren't here. So thank you guys for making things smooth. And we've had also wonderful support from the City of Ballarat, Sovereign Hill. We're going to enjoy Blood on the Southern Cross tonight. So Ian can perhaps have a look at how two narratives work for different audiences and products that are improved, even when the market is telling them that they may not need improvement. Also critical, I think, has been the fantastic support we've had from the Ballarat Tourist Association and the presence of operators when we thought many of you would be flat out with checkout. Thank you for coming along, and Ian has a little time if some of you who haven't put a question would like to have some discussions. But as Andy said, we're looking forward to sharing occasionally more of these occasional guests with the city. And we thank you all for coming this morning and giving your time, and we're very happy to have shared our expert with you this morning. Thank you.
That's all right. I was going to hope that was all right.
Very enjoyable. Sorry.
Blanking out.
It stopped at the end there.
I don't know what I'm pushing about.
Yes, it's just a sign of its own. Anyway, you start. Smooth your sails for all of that. That's okay. That's very good. Yeah, she just luckily happened to look around and bump something or get the circuit going. Yes, excellent. Hope that's what you wanted. Yeah, yeah, that's great. Very stimulating. Yeah, you can't drop off at it. That's the stuff I think just get people. Yes, and I think futures are futures are creative in a lot of life, but it's very interesting just to project trends and, yeah, and look at different, you know, and if you don't like what the future is telling you, get in and just I think, as you messaged, yeah, take, yeah, the future. You don't predict the future. That's it. And I think people can feel a bit isolated in thinking that the trends are impacting on them particularly, but Having the global lessons, it's very evident there's a set of global issues going on, but there's a way of talking to that community.
Yeah, yeah, so it's great. So we're picking up tonight, aren't we?
That's right. 6:30 at the Hill.
At Silver Hill?
Yes. I think if we just go to the front entrance, there'll be security and sticker sales going on there. Yeah, and I must get a briefing.